The House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee will be coming to order. We do have a quorum, and Representative Gilman moves approval of the meeting minutes from March 6, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion carries, and the minutes from March 6, 2025 are approved. Today we have an overview of the February forecast that came out last Thursday. So without further ado, welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the records and present our forecast.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is David Greenman. I'm the serve as the CFO for the Department of Human Services, and with me I have our budget director, Elise Bailey, who I think you all know. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to present the DFL portion of our DFL impact, or sorry, DHS impacts of the February 2025 forecast.
DHS. Thank you, Freud.
Yes, yes. We are going to be presenting you with a lot of numbers today, and I want to provide some background on how to interpret them for those of you who may be new. The February forecast reflects changes in projected spending for forecasted programs operated by DHS relative to the projections from the previous November forecast. And the difference between the two forecasts is we have additional data in which to base our estimates and our projections. The forecast covers, also another thing to know is the forecast covers projected spending for the current biennium, which is fiscal years 24 and 25. The next biennium, or the biennium for which you're going to be setting the budget, which is fiscal years 26, 27, and then the planning years, which are fiscal years 28 and 29. And for the record, forecasted programs are programs where eligibility rules are set in statute, benefit levels or benefit sets are also established in statute. Payment rates are in statute. The program itself is in statute. And the appropriations for those programs are based on what is projected in the forecast, based on use of the program. Ms. Bailey's going to talk a little bit more about what specific forecasted programs DHS operates, because with the separation of DHS into different agencies, there are some forecasted programs that had been at DHS that are moving, and so for the record, we'll be reporting on those. I think the last thing I would want to be sure to mention on the forecast when we do forecasts is we base it on state and federal law. We don't try to predict what's going to happen in the future. But as we'll cover at the end of the presentation, we do need to make some. We do certainly keep an eye on what's happening at the state and federal level, because for planning purposes, we need to understand and assess what possible changes are that may be coming. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Bailey to start going through high-level basics of the forecast and the first several impacts that we're going to talk about.
Welcome to the committee, Director Bailey. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your report.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. Elise Bailey, Budget Director. Happy to be here to go over our updated forecast with you. So I'll start and then pass it back to CFO Greenman for the remaining slides. So this slide number 2 is just a picture of what our current budget is based on the different funding streams that DHS has. And I presented this to you a few weeks ago with the recommendations of the governor's budget, and this has been updated for the February forecast. As you can see, about 55% now of our funding in fiscal year 26 is projected to come from the federal government, with 37% from the general fund. Most of that is kind of what you're deliberating here, of course, in this committee. And then the HCAF, or Healthcare Access Fund, about 5% of our budget comes from that. And then just 3% of other sources, such as the Opioid Epidemic Response Fund and other smaller funds. Again, I'd like to show the number of people that are served with those big numbers that we have, just to put in perspective the magnitude of the people impacted across the state. This slide also I showed a few weeks ago, and the percentages haven't changed with the February forecast. So about 89% of our funding is on medical assistance, or Medicaid, and 6% is in the other forecasted programs that we'll also go over today. And 3% is in grant programs, and just 2% of our budget is spent on staff and IT costs. So in fiscal year 26, we have a state budget of about $9.6 billion. So this excludes the federal funding and on Medicaid. And about $4.9 billion of that is spent in long-term care. So this is nursing homes, waivers, and home care. So that's about 51% of the state funding for medical assistance goes towards those programs within the Medicaid program. $2.6 billion is for what we call the basic care portion of Medicaid for older adults and people with disabilities, or 27% of our state funding. And $1.8 billion is spent, or 19% is spent on children and families basic care. Just $295 million, or 3%, is spent on adults without kids. And that number is so small, again, because we have about 90% federal match for that population. This slide goes over those federal matches, and so as you kind of think about solutions in your committee on how to balance the budget, along with some looming federal changes, it really does matter on how much the feds kick in for each service and each population. So this slide gives a nice snapshot of what the current state is for each population we serve. So we, of course, have other forecasted programs. So Minnesota Care, with the February forecast, about $104 million in state funding. Housing support is a state-only program, so we don't have a federal match here, hence the large cost of $269 million comparatively to the rest of the non-MA forecasted programs. The Behavioral Health Fund, we also have some state-only funded within there that isn't funded by the Medicaid program of about $138 million. General assistance, $84 million. Minnesota Supplemental Aid, serving older adults, folks with on Social Security, of about $67 million. And then alternative care of about $56 million. Slide 7 just gives a snapshot of the difference between the November forecast and the February forecast by fund. And so looking at the general fund, in the current biennium and the next biennium, we have about 1.9% increase over those two bienniums. And then in the tails, or in fiscal year 28-29, about 1.6% increase. You'll see in the healthcare access fund, we're also projecting an increase, and those are in the next biennium in the planning years of about 3.3% and 3.9%. Slide 8 goes over a snapshot of what the changes we're seeing by forecasted program. In general assistance, housing support, and Minnesota supplemental aid, those changes are relatively small, just based on updated data on the people that we're serving and the payments that we're making. In this presentation, we're not planning to dive deep into those just because of the magnitude being pretty small, but we'll go over in detail on MA, Minnesota Care, and the Behavioral Health Fund changes. So looking across the forecast, we have four kind of key changes that you'll see. We're seeing increased disability waiver spending growth, as we did in November. We're in the February forecast, that is moving up even further. We also see in the MA basic program some changes in payments to managed care orgs and the fee-for-service portion based on updated claims and level of acuity now that the unwinding project is done. We've also updated our managed care rates and fee-for-service rates based on the updated costs of weight loss drugs, and Mr. Greenman will go over that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Behavioral Health Fund and some changes in the federal and state match around some services. Slide 10 goes over just a historical picture updated by this February forecast on the total costs in the medical assistance program. Just a good snapshot of where we're at. So diving deep into the main drivers of the forecast, as I said, we're continuing to see trends going up in the disability waiver programs. And in this forecast, those are a few different drivers. We're finding that the disability waiver rate system inflationary adjustments set to occur in 26-28 are estimated to result in higher average payments of about 1% higher than previously projected. We're projecting about 13.9% and 7.67% in the planning year. We're also seeing average payment data from early 2025 trending higher than we previously forecasted. So the number of services that are billed and claimed and the total cost of those are higher in addition to those inflationary adjustments. We're also seeing a growth in the number of people that are served on the DD waiver, particularly around kids and youth. And so the base forecast in that waiver is increasing by about 1% to account for serving more children. Across all of these factors, the total impact is $35 million in the current biennium, $160 million in the next, and in the planning years, $141 million. Some other changes in long-term care related to nursing homes, we're seeing the average payment operating rate increases a little bit higher than the previous forecast, as well as increased number of paid days due to an upturn from a flatter trend than we had previously projected. So at total, that's about $9 million in the next biennium and $11 million in the planning years. We also have some changes in this forecast on related to updates and implementation of the CFSS, or Community First Services and Supports Program. This is a program that the PCA program is transitioning to, and we started that transition in October of 2024. This forecast is updated due to a slower transition over to CFSS from PCA. And as people transition to CFSS, we will draw down an enhanced federal match of 6% compared to what match we would receive when folks were on the PCA program. So this forecast just accounts for that slower transition over to the new program. The legislature also authorized the ability for a state-funded parent and spousal caregiver option in the PCA program. This is available under CFSS. That would get the federal match, but under PCA, under that federal authority, it is not. So it's all state-funded. Due to the slower take-up and the slower transition of CFSS, as well as a higher take-up of that parent and spousal caregiver option, that also is increasing the cost of this portion of the forecast. It's about $20 million in this biennium and $9 million in the next, but no impact in the 28-29 planning years because these are all related to the transition over to CFSS. Moving into basic care, there's a few drivers where we're seeing increased costs. Related to our fee-for-service payments, we're seeing higher than expected average payment experience as part of the transition coming out of the pandemic, where declining average payments were occurring in the pandemic, and now we're seeing a little bit of an uptick. This is $65 million in the current biennium, $75 million in the next, and $98 million in the planning years. Managed care payments are also growing. We have had to amend our capitation payments with our managed care organizations due to increased acuity. And this is really due to the unwinding process where, of course, during the pandemic, the feds required us to not make sure that people maintained coverage during that time until the federal public health emergency ended. And then when that ended, we started re-enrolling folks and checking their, making sure that they were eligible for the program. So folks dropped off as they weren't eligible for the program, and now we're just updating the capitation payments to account for the current level of acuity for the population. We're also updating the enrollment in this updated enrollment following the unwinding. Well, I already said that, sorry. $31 million in 24-25 is the reason for this, and it's not, it's just a current update for this current year because we had already updated the out years in the previous forecast. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Greenman to go over the remaining slides.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the next item we're going to discuss is pharmacy payments through the Medicaid program. In particular, a change in the or update to the contract with managed care plans related to the coverage of weight loss drugs, or what were known as GLP-1 drugs. We are seeing weight loss, as a little bit of background, weight loss drugs were first covered in fiscal year 2022. At that time, there were two drugs that were FDA approved that were covered by the Medicaid program, and those were in short supply. So the uptake was fairly small at that time. Over the last couple of years, we've seen a pretty significant, we've seen more drugs, at least one other FDA approved drug and additional therapies added to the Medicaid coverage. And so we're seeing a dramatic increase in both claims and spending on weight loss drugs in the last year. And with data that we've gotten from the close of calendar year 2024, it was determined that there is a continued ongoing increase in spending. The total impact is about 11.7 million state share in 24-25, the current biennium. We're projecting about 78.7 million in the next biennium, and about 87.6 million in state spending in the planning years. And there's also a Minnesota Care impact, which we'll talk about in a bit. A couple things to note. In states where Medicaid does cover weight loss drugs, we are required to cover any FDA-approved drug for weight loss as long as the manufacturer is willing to accept the Medicaid rebate, be in the Medicaid rebate program. There are a number of things that we do to try to manage access and ensure there's access, appropriate access. On the fee-for-service side, DHS does require prior authorization for the use of weight loss drugs, as do most, if not all, managed care plans. We also place quantity limits on weight loss drugs, and typically if there's a prior authorization and we're finding that on adults at least, if weight loss drugs are not having an impact on weight, then it's likely that the PA will not be, prior authorization would not be renewed. So that's weight loss drugs. The next item we're going to talk about in the forecast reflects the cost of retroactively correcting the funding source charged for services provided by seven residential substance use disorder providers in the state. Since 2015, DHS had been claiming federal reimbursement for services from these providers. However, in December of 2024, staff discovered that these providers are not eligible for federal funding due to their status as institutions for mental disease. Instead, they were eligible for state funding. IMDs are, just for a little bit of background, Institutions for Mental Disease, or IMDs, is a federal designation that refers to substance use disorder providers, or SUD providers, with greater than 16 beds. Historically, IMDs have not been eligible for federal reimbursement, so instead have been covered with state dollars. These seven IMDs are operated by tribal governments. There's a little bit of background. And as some of you may know, in fiscal year 2020, state law was changed so that IMDs that met certain standards had the option of enrolling in a federal SUD waiver that does provide a federal match on the cost of services. And as of January 1, 2024, most IMDs were required to enroll in the SUD waiver. The exception was for tribal IMDs because of their sovereign status, who may enroll voluntarily. Since discovering these IMDs had been submitting claims for services provided, and we were reimbursing them at the correct rate, and for the services they provided, the problem was they were being reimbursed with federal funds, and they should have been reimbursed with state dollars. Since we discovered the error, DHS staff took immediate action to diagnose the problem and fix it. In the process, we verified that, as I said, all claims were paid out over the 10 years, were at the correct rate, and for legitimately provided treatment. We did immediately notify the legislative auditor, CMS, and MMB, and have kept them updated throughout this process. What the forecast reflects is a $113 million state expenditure from the Behavioral Health Fund and a corresponding reduction in the federal spend from that same fund in fiscal year 25 to retroactively correct the source of funding to the IMDs over the last 10 years. In addition to that, going forward, the state expenditures for these IMDs are projected, we are projecting state expenditures in fiscal years 25 and 26 to pay for the services provided by these IMDs going forward. That would be about $12 million in fiscal year 25 and $19 million in 26, 27. And as I said, that these tribal governments may voluntarily enroll in the USUD waiver. Under state law, since January of 24, they've been required to meet the standards necessary to enroll. However, we believe that they may not have been aware that they weren't enrolled because they were just submitting claims. They were doing what they needed to do. They were submitting claims for their services. They were reimbursed, getting reimbursed. The error was on the DHS side. So we've been, DHS leadership has been meeting with tribal leadership to discuss this issue, to make sure they're aware of it, they're continuing to be paid at the same rate that they qualify for. But we've been notifying them as well of the situation and offering to any support or help we can provide should they choose to enroll in the waiver. One of the things we had to do with this forecast is make some assumptions about whether they would enroll, knowing that they can do it voluntarily, but they don't have to. For the purposes of this forecast, we have made an assumption that over the next 2.5 years, they will enroll in the SUD waiver, and so will qualify for federal funding. So we do project some state spending in the next 2.5 years to reimburse these providers going forward, but that we assume that by within the next 2.5 years, they will all be enrolled in the program. If that is not the case, we'll make an adjustment to the forecast, but that's what we're assuming right now. This is obviously a pretty significant error on the part of the department. Staff, it happened 10 years ago. Current staff were able to discover the error and act quickly to make sure that we stopped making the federal payments, and we notified the federal government immediately as the OLA as well. Couple things, to be completely honest, this is what keeps me up at night, these kinds of things. I will say that these are unusual services in that most of the time when there's a service covered by DHS, there's one payment source. It's either federal, it's state, or it's federal and state match, like Medicaid. This is unusual in that it could either be 100% state if it's an IMD that's not in the waiver, or it's 100% federal if it's either not an IMD or if it's an IMD in the waiver. That's one of the challenges here, that, or at least it creates a risk that we need to be closer coordinated between the people who set our rates and the people who do our policy work. Since this happened, we've instituted continuous improvement efforts to try to create a process that's going to ensure going forward that we have much closer coordination and much more financial controls in place to make sure that this doesn't happen again. The one thing I do want to stress, though, is that these providers were not eligible for federal funding in any situation at this point. So these are funds that would have been paid by the state either way. The problem is we're having to pay them right now instead of paying them year over year since 2015. And going forward, we'll be making additional adjustments to our processes to make sure that this doesn't happen again in the future. Go to the next slide. The next item we're going to talk about is the Minnesota Care impacts in this forecast. These somewhat reflect what Ms. Bailey was talking about in the Medicaid area. Probably the biggest impact on Minnesota Care is in weight loss drugs. They have an impact as well. And also, that's probably the more significant Minnesota Care impact. The other is on enrollment. And again, we're seeing higher than expected enrollment, which is resulting in an increase in base funding for the Minnesota Care program. The last thing I guess I would say is, as I mentioned at the outset, we don't try to predict what's going to happen in state and federal law. However, I think, given the outsized impact that Medicaid has in the state, throughout the state, I think we need to be paying we all need to be paying close attention to what's happening and assessing actions that are occurring at the federal level. given the fact that Medicaid covers about 1.2 million Minnesotans throughout the state and provides about $20 billion in payments to providers, and as well as administrative funding to counties and tribes. The federal share of Medicaid spending is about $13 billion a year, which amounts to about 17% of all state spending. So all the entire state government, if you take not just the general fund, but all funding, it's about 17% of state spending per year. The one thing I would say is, first and foremost, there's a significant amount of uncertainty over what might happen at the federal level. And we've obviously been watching very carefully what's happening in Congress. We also know that there have been no proposals introduced thus far to change Medicaid at this point. And the legislative process will ultimately require a significant, compromise negotiations between the House and the Senate. It is noteworthy that the House budget resolution does include $880 billion or directs the committee overseeing Medicaid and Medicare to reduce spending by $880 billion over the next 10 years. And if you take Medicare out of the equation, there's only about $135 billion that's available that's not Medicaid or CHIP that's available for reducing. So there would potentially be a pretty significant cut in Medicaid, again, if that were to happen. And we don't know what that's going to look like yet. But that amount of reduction would be about a 10 to 12% reduction in Medicaid, federal Medicaid outlays, which, if it were passed along proportionally to states, Minnesota's share would be about $1.4 billion to $1.6 billion a year. The impact on Minnesota, the specific impact on Minnesota would depend heavily on what if any measures are taken, how those cuts are enacted, whether they're through an FMAP reduction, whether through caps or block grants, or through some impact on the healthcare taxes that Minnesota has. It's hard to know what those are, but there's a lot of uncertainty right now. I think that's kind of the key word, not knowing really what might be coming, but we have been working hard to try to assess what those potential impacts might look like, because if we are in a situation where we do have reductions in Medicaid, we'll have to respond quickly and understand what our options are. The last is some resources we have related to the forecast, related to Medicaid spending, just looking for providing additional information if you have questions. Obviously, we're here to answer any questions you have as well, but wanted to make sure that you were aware that seeing our Medicaid information as well for further background.
All right. CFO Greenman, Director Bailey, thank you for your presentation of the forecast. Members, we have the next hour and 15 minutes for questions. I'm sure both are very excited for this portion of the piece. And we'll start with Representative Backer.
Thank you, and we appreciate you doing that. My first question, I have several. My first question deals with the forecasts showing that we're basically upside down with medical assistance, with the increase of coming in. What's being done at the department to make sure, especially on our border parts of our state, that those medical assistance are being paid to Minnesotans and not somebody that lives in South Dakota or North Dakota or Florida or other parts here, Chair? That would be my first question.
Mr. Chair, Senator, Representative Backer, couple things, I guess. If it's about enrollees in medical assistance, they have to have established citizen or residency in Minnesota to be eligible and need to be living and have a permanent residency in Minnesota. They have to renew every year to make sure that they are still residents. And so the services have to be, I think the services can be provided by a provider outside the state, but they have to be residents of Minnesota to be in the program.
Representative Backer.
So how is that verified? And I'm not referring to the provider, so maybe my question was not clear. How is it verified that they're Minnesota residents? Is there a verification process, or does a person just fill in a sheet and say, hey, I live in Minnesota? What verification process that our taxpayers are paying for medical assistance saying person ABC, because Minnesotans like helping Minnesotans, but that's what we want to do is help Minnesotans. How is it verified? Because I understand that they do a sheet, but is there a verification process, or does the individual fill out the sheet? You know, for example, in Browns Valley, we have Browns Valley, Minnesota address, but they live in South Dakota. There's quite a few people on the Lake Road, just how the postal works, but they live in South Dakota, but they'll put down Browns Valley, Minnesota, even though they live in South Dakota just because of the school district. So what does the department do to verify that? Is there a verification process, or are they only looking from the sheet saying, okay, the person said that, they're Minnesota residents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Acker, I think that's a great question. I think at this time, we have to be very vigilant about making sure that we're spending every dollar on Minnesota residents to serve Minnesota residents. The specifics of what we check and verify when they apply is something I have a sense of what we do, but I think I prefer to make sure we're getting you the right answer. So I'd like to ask if we could get back to you about that, about the specifics of exactly what we do. Mm-hmm. But that is something that I share your concern about being sure that we are spending every dollar that we can to serve Minnesotans.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, I would appreciate that because, of course, I'm skittish because of the $125 million challenge, hiccup, error. However, I've had constituents who have used stronger words than that with the tribal. So if you could get that with me because it is important to make sure we're dotting I's and crossing T's, because DHS, and you guys are in the hot seat. DHS does not have the best record for payments. So let's jump to the tribal behavioral health situation that last Tuesday you broke to us, and I appreciate that. How many tribes? Was nine tribes involved with that?
I believe, Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, I believe there are four tribes that operate the seven particular IMDs.
Okay.
Representative Backer.
And so help me understand. So since 2015, those payments, they were coming out of a federal coffin instead of the state coffin, okay, to the providers, okay? So this was happening since 2015 for basically 10 years, month after month after month after month. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, that's correct. At 2015, there was a, you know, and again, I wish I could say I know what happened exactly, what decisions were made and why that was decided and who made the error. Unfortunately, I wasn't there at the time. But there was, yes, these IMDs have been submitting claims for the service they legitimately provide. We've been paying the claims at the correct encounter rate. They get an encounter rate that applies whether they get federal funding or state funding. At the time, they were not identified as IMDs. They should have been identified as IMDs. They were not. And so those payments have continued to be made since 2015. And in 2024, we identified that, in fact, these were IMDs and they should have not been paid with state or federal funds. They should have been paid with state dollars.
Representative Becker.
And thank you. And this probably will be harsh. It just seems like someone's sleeping at the wheel for 10 years. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of money. I know it was before your time, but at the end of the day, DHS is responsible for taxpayers' dollars. And it seems very slothful. I'm going to use some bold words, slothful, lazy. From a constituent perspective that I was talking to this weekend, like how in the Sam heck does that happen? I'm glad that you're talking about putting procedures in place and so forth. But if it was done outside in a private enterprise, that person or persons, I think it's more than one, who would lost their job. Because from an outside, what it looks like is, okay, person needs payment. So what we have is we have a robot each month, or robots that are making payments. Now, I'm glad that you caught it now, okay, instead of another 5-10 years down the road. So it's extremely troubling to see that happening over a 10-year period, you know, 12 months, and, you know, and DHS already has some egg on their face with other issues that you're aware of. So the next thing that I have, one more thing.
Representative Backer.
And this deals with efficiencies and so forth, and deals with child protection and SSIS. I understand that there was money appropriated for enhancing that child protection system, you know, the green screen that no one likes, that is really a pain in the butt for county and creates high amount of inefficiencies. I understand there's 8 or 9 other states that run child protection through their through the county. Has anybody looked at seeing what those counties do, copy what they do? Because there was money appropriated, I understand. We still have this tremendous frustration. DHS is passing in the governor's forecast is putting more responsibilities on the county. We got to find efficiencies. Where are we at with that? Or is that just something that is sitting on the shelf and not getting accomplished?
CFO Grimmon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Backer, regarding the SSIS funding appropriated to SSIS, it was for SSIS. It was appropriated to DHS, but it's now sitting with the Department of Children, Youth, and Families as they work on that project. I believe there is some work going on right now. I don't know exactly what the status of it is, but that's certainly something we can get that information for you and get back to you, because I know that is a major issue for counties and for others who use that system and have been frustrated with it. And so happy to get back to you on that. I think, just if I could respond to your previous comments, what happened and the mistake that happened is not, obviously that's not something that we want to do. That's not the way that we want to operate. And I do very much appreciate the fact that staff came forward, they identified it, they quickly came forward, and we are responding quickly to it. That doesn't mean that it should have happened or that we should be happy about that. As the CFO, despite the fact that I wasn't there at the time, that doesn't make me any less accountable. And that's why I'm here. I have to be able to give you answers when you ask those questions. And so we are working to try to address these kinds of issues as they come up. It's been a major priority for me and especially for Commissioner Gandhi at this point. What I can try to do is get you as many answers as I can about how it happened and what we're planning to do about it going forward, and continue to work with you to answer any questions I can about.
Thank you. That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Senator Hicks.
Thank you so much for this presentation. I did want to clarify one thing as the policy person who worked in count, like, did the how to get Medicaid thing for a long time. MnSure is how most people apply for Medicaid if they're not applying for other benefits. And MnSure actually links directly to your taxes. So it would have, that is how we verify everything in MnSure, is it links directly to your taxes and your bank accounts, which is kind of a fun little feature that makes it way easy for people to apply, but it also helps us make sure that they live where they're supposed to, because it links to their taxes. If folks are applying for multiple benefits and using the combined form, they have to submit proofs, and those happen on your county levels. And so I want to give our counties credit for how much of this fraud prevention we put on our counties. We ask them to do so much, to collect pay stubs, to collect leases, to collect bank statements. It's just a lot that we ask them to do. And so I just want to sort of step into that space and defend them a little bit for the hard work that they do to make sure that they are using taxpayer dollars appropriately too. So that was just me wanting to defend our counties a bit for that space. But on to some of the forecast pieces. Can you help me understand? I know we've talked a lot about long-term care and how those things impact the forecast. How are we projecting for the gray-silver tsunami that's coming, not just in the two-year budget, you know, forecast that we see and have concerns with, but even further out as our current 60-year-olds become 80-year-olds?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Hicks, that's a really great question. We are using demographic data, my understanding, to trend up how many people we anticipate being served, in addition to what our actual experience is right here and now. So this forecast is updating for the current folks that we, the updated claims since November, but generally we do have trends in the forecast according to how many we expect to serve. I would say the silver tsunami isn't really before us yet, actually. We haven't hit the peak. And so when we see the max impact of that, it's far, far, far off the spreadsheet at this point. So, but we are, like I said, we're trending in our forecast according to how many people we anticipate to serve over time.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I think we have to deal with the problems in front of us, and I appreciate that. But I also, you know, sat around tables 15 years ago where everybody told me in between 2020 and 2025 we were going to have a care shortage. And I was sat at tables where people had all kinds, everybody doomed and gloomed and nobody made anything different. And then 2020 got here and we all went, oh, well, that didn't work. So I just want to keep our focus on the silver tsunami that's coming because we're not there yet, and I think we need to plan for it.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 10 or 20 years ago, I sat before a group of county commissioners, and they talked about how social spending in the county just keeps growing as a ratio of their total spending. They have no control over it. It just keeps growing, and it's now impacting infrastructure and all the other kind of spending that the counties need to do. We see the same thing happening at the state level, which is a concern for some of us, maybe all of us, that spending is creeping up and eating away at our ability to fund all these other necessary things, K-12 education, infrastructure, public safety, you know, the other pillars of what make for quality of life in a state, in a region. So, you know, we want to protect those most vulnerable, of course. Any conversation about cost containment, let's make it abundantly clear. Older folks, folks with disabilities, we care deeply about them, and we're going to make sure that they're well taken care of. But inside of all of this, how do we find cost containment? Are we going to be able to have the conversation about maybe we have to adjust the qualifications of how to get into these programs? Maybe there is some efficiency that you all see from the inside. I know government at its best is a watchdog for waste, fraud, abuse. I mean, efficiency, all these things, you know, in the business culture, they're always talking about lean, right? Let's run a lean organization. Have you guys brought in some of these principles into your program? And if you were looking for cost containment, where would you start? I'm not saying you are looking for cost containment, but if you were, where would you find that efficiency so that we can some way contain this as a ratio of our state budget?
Agreement.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's a great question because as an agency that's seeing costs increase and as we're seeing a population that's aging, and as you say, we're trying to serve the most vulnerable in the state, we've got to make sure that every dollar we spend counts. And so I think there's a couple ways of doing that. Representative Hicks talked about the aging of the population and having to try to plan for and prepare for that. In some ways, I think we have very smart policy people that work at DHS that look at what are some options out there, what are some other states doing, what are some things to think about innovative ways to serve people that maybe involve less spending. And those are things that we would work with you on, because you're going to come up with the ideas too. I think it also means working with our partners, working with our counties, working with our tribes, working with our providers to identify where those benefits or options can be going forward, because we're not going to be able to do this on our own. We have to rely on others as well to try to maintain or manage costs over time. The reality is we do have increasing costs, and we've got to find a way to control the spending as much as possible to keep it affordable and to make sure we have enough money to meet our needs. Frankly, I think one way in which there's a way to get some efficiency or remove some inefficiencies, and it was brought up earlier around the SSIS system, there's a lot of inefficiencies in how we run our programs. We have a lot of aging IT systems that really create a lot of, frankly, they create risks. They're difficult to work with. They slow things down. Making improvements and fixing some of those IT systems is probably going to have a pretty significant impact on what we do and how we do it. But I do think we need to do some really hard thinking in the next several years about what we're going to do going forward and how we're going to do it and address it. And there's a lot of deep thinkers at DHS, but there's a lot of deep thinkers outside of DHS that need to be doing some of this as well.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope that this continues, this two-way street that we have, because some of it falls on us, right? If we're saying we do need to find this cost containment and we are willing to look at eligibility requirements to get into some of these programs, then we can feed that back to you and you guys can give us the information on what effect would that have on overall cost. We heard some testimony, so relative to cost going out and cost containment, we heard some testimony in the last week or so that we're currently reimbursing some of our providers at like 29 to 30% of billed amounts and about 60% of Medicare allowed amounts. And all the subset providers are coming in saying we should probably be at least at the Medicare amount. Oh, so should we. So that's not going to drive costs down. If we can get to properly reimbursing these providers, it's going to actually add some costs. So we're going to have to try to factor that in as well. Mr. Chair, may I ask one more question?
Senator Gander.
Thank you so much. Now back to GLP-1s like Ozempic, and I know that's a class of medicines. Has there been any sort of estimate that would be the cost savings of folks using these medicines? I understand we're treating diabetes over here and bringing down A1Cs, but we're also treating folks who are not diabetic for weight loss. We're going to be preventing diabetes. We're going to be preventing hypertension. We're going to be preventing hypercholesterolemia. And so these long-term health benefits on the back end should be pretty significant. If we drop, 60, 70, 80 pounds on some obese folks, love them dearly. And if this is a game changer for them, are we looking at, kind of that fiscal note? What's that long-term cost savings from a healthier, more lean group of folks? Thank you.
How is that dynamic scoring going, CFO?
Thanks for that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative, that is a great question. It's something we've been thinking about too. Is as we're seeing greater use of weight loss drugs, where are the, when would we be seeing the benefits? As you know, not only is it a question of rules around dynamic scoring in terms of pricing these things, but it's also the budget horizon that we look at. We have a 4-year budget horizon. And I would presume that the kind of benefits you'd expect to see in terms of healthier population with weight loss drugs are likely going to see those beyond that 4-year horizon mainly. And so we do expect to see those impacts. However, it's going to be built into the forecast. It's going to be in 6, 8, 10 years from now, you might see a lower spend on Medicaid basic care, or maybe fewer people on Medicaid if people are healthier and they're able to be in a position where they're not economically it's necessary for them to be on Medicaid. At this point, we weren't able to project what those savings are. I think there's probably some research out there that would look at that, but it's a great question, and it's one that we often get around, like, what is the health benefits of these different actions? And there are rules around, legislative budgeting rules around how you price those or don't price those, but there's also the budget horizon that sort of limits our scope of looking at those.
One last comment, if I may, Mr.
Representative Gander.
Inside the diabetic subset, you're going to see benefits way sooner, because I've seen firsthand you drop that 40, 60, 80 pounds, and you can get off your hypertensive med, you can get off your cholesterol med. So those benefits are going to be way inside that 4-year window. But I know we're talking about same med for weight loss. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gander. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the department for being here today and for the presentation. I know that we've spent a bit of time talking about Medicaid and what the potential might be happening from the federal side. The area I'm wanting to dive into a little bit more, and while they're not the same size dollars as we have on the Medicaid side, is in the behavioral health area. I know that we have block grants that come in from the federal government. If you could just give us an idea of what the size of that is and what you're hearing from the federal side, because this is an area where in behavioral health we're losing so much. You know, we're so far behind to start with for reimbursement rates and everything else. Is just want to get a little bit more idea of where it's going right now and what you're hearing that might be happening on the federal side, because if it's not MA, it might be even more up for being cut.
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Bailey might be pulling some data for you right now. We do get annual block grants through SAMHSA, which is a federal agency. It's in the $10 to $13 million a year range, and I think some of them are specifically for mental health, and some of them are for substance use. In the last several years, we've gotten a lot of additional grants through as a result of COVID, and those are largely sort of coming to the end. We still continue to receive the SAMHSA block grants. There's a lot of there's uncertainty around those as well. Frankly, we've got the potential for a federal shutdown coming up. The impact of that, which is we're closely monitoring and assessing right now. We've not seen any indication that the funding for our block grants is going to change. But again, there is some uncertainty around that with the recent pause in financial assistance. There's a temporary restraining order on that right now. It's hard to know exactly what. I know that a lot of grants are being examined sort of by the federal government in different ways. But right now, I don't know of any changes in those funds. I don't know if that's answering your question or not.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. It answers to my questions and also created another question. Is you're mentioning that you mentioned pause. So are some of the grants that were the behavioral health block grants that we're getting, my understanding then, when I hear pause, that some of those were put on pause, and then you said the courts have blocked those pauses right now. Am I understanding right? So depending how the courts rule, those pauses could be put back in place and then we'd not be able to draw those funds?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, honestly, I think that's where the uncertainty is. It's hard to know what would be the impact of those changes. I wish I had a better answer for you. The pause was put in place very briefly and then it was blocked. So the impact of knowing what the impact is, it's difficult to know. I know that there are some federal grants where the funds are being received more slowly. These are different agencies. DHS has not encountered any of that at this point. So it's hard to know what the impact is going to be, but we are watching very carefully. And as we draw our federal funds, the folks who work in our receipt center, we call it, they're letting us know every day, are they having any trouble drawing the funds? And at this point, we're not seeing any of that. When we attempt to draw federal funds, we're getting those dollars as we request them, but we are watching very carefully.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher, and thank you for that information. I'm glad to hear that we're able to draw on the funds right now. What is highly concerning is that this is an area that we know has been underfunded for years, and we're seeing more and more people needing services. And it troubles me to hear that the federal government feels this is an area that we could just wantonly go in and defund and not have proper oversight and things going on. I think that is a major concern. Thankfully, a court stepped in. Hopefully, they can come out with a ruling that the president will abide by, but at the same time, I'm very concerned about the haphazardness of the cuts that are coming from, that are being instituted by President Trump and his handler, Elon Musk.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know who I should direct this to, if it's Mr. Greenman or Director Bailey. On slide 12, we're talking about the CFSS program, the PCA folks. curious if you have numbers to show how have we grown in the state-funded, like the parental or spousal caregiver support. Has that program grown, like, over the last several years or in the last couple of years? Are we getting more and more folks that are using that program?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Goodman, I can get you that data. All I know is that when we, during the pandemic, we had a temporary ability to fund parents and spouses under the PCA program, which is a different federal kind of funding source than, say, the new CFSS program. And it wasn't allowable typically, but due to the pandemic, it was allowable for a short period of time. The legislature then kind of funded a state-only option to maintain access due to the caregiver shortage. Folks are really having a hard time. Even though our spending is going up, we still are at a point in Minnesota's long-term care industry where it is challenging to find workers to support people. And so my understanding, the vision behind you all passing that was to ensure that people continue to have access. And so it was a short kind of time-limited option because it was then again going to be available via a federal funding source once we shifted to CFSS. But I can get you the exact number of people for your knowledge.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And so just to follow up on that, the PCA training and eligibility piece of it, when we talk about shortages, what are the steps that are needed to ensure that, that people are qualified PCAs to do that?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, that's a great question. I believe there is a required training, but I don't have a lot, all the details on what are the hours and the requirements behind it, so I'd have to get back to you on that as well.
Representative Gilman.
All right, thank you. And so just to wrap it up here, I'm concerned that, you know, during the pandemic, we talk about that, and then now it's shifted to state only, and it's going to phase out. It looks like here it's just slowly going to phase out. How do we know, again, we were back to Chair Backer talking earlier, you know, if folks that are receiving these services truly are in need of them, so we can ensure that the people that truly need services are getting them. You know, I've talked to a vendor, and I'm actually going to point him to the whistleblower portion of things that we've talked about, where there's folks that are signing up, you know, 20, 30 new clients every single month. They'll you know, hop on the program. Both parents, it's the same situation. It's different folks, but they're hopping on these programs, and they'll sign up for 3 years of support, and then it's just a very challenging situation. So I'd like to know, like, eligibility wise, how do we know that there's actually people that are requiring these services that are that are entitled to them, and that there's not an opportunity for fraud, waste, and abuse to be happening. And then I think about, you know, people in my community and all of our communities that are scared, and phone calls I've gotten going, hey, is Vicki going to get the services that we need? Because we are on a fixed income. We stay home with our daughter who's needing support, and we actually are her caregivers. And then those folks are, like, flipping out right now, and there's just this massive influx. So I want to see how many in the last 4 years or since COVID, since that shift happened and the legislature said, hey, we're going to lock arms with people and ensure that people are taken care of, how many people are actually could exploit that opportunity that we were throwing them an opportunity. So,
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Gilman, I would say that the eligibility requirements for PCA are more expansive than just being eligible for MA. They have to have a functional eligibility to receive PCA, meaning that they have to have needs in the areas of activities of daily living. So there are assessments required of the person before the services can be authorized.
Okay.
Representative Gilman.
That's great to hear. Okay. And then, if you could get back to me just on the growth of that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Representative Corinne.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the information today. Well, I think first it's clear that this committee is charged with a pretty heavy responsibility going over the next couple of years. And I think, you know, in general, roughly Minnesota gets about half of our funding from the federal government. Other states receive, most other states receive more federal funding than Minnesota does. And I worry that expected federal cuts will start to pit some states against each other, even more so, and sort of like having folks just dive for the closest penny that they can get and start fighting against each other, when what we're really, really talking about here are real people who are all of our constituents, who are our neighbors with real needs, and some who, frankly, won't survive without the care they need. And that's, you know, I'm not being dramatic when I say that, and I hope that folks here take that genuinely from me. I think we can find ways to save money, to pinch pennies, but there's a lot of folks out there receiving unpaid services through family members who are just caring for loved ones, folks who weren't able to get through the assessment process for one reason or another. A lot of the assessment processes are quite intensive to make sure that people are eligible, and to the point where sometimes that's even a barrier for people to even get the services that they need. And so that you know, brings me to my question. You mentioned the lack of workforce already. So we have that pool of people who are maybe just totally unserved or being served with unpaid labor from family members, right? So my question then is, do you have any sort of sense of the number of people who might be eligible who just aren't using state services right now? And if they did go through the hoops to get on services, how much we might truly be spending on this?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schellmacher, Representative. No, that's a great question. We don't know the counterfactual, right? We don't know the people who aren't coming through our doors, aren't submitting claims. And so we forecast just on a cash basis, which is what we're actually paying. So that is a great question. And we do know, as I said before, there is a workforce shortage. And I think the task at hand is extremely challenging. As you saw when we talked about the governor's budget and going to Representative Gander's question about, do you have ideas? Yes, we have ideas. Every idea is a challenging one. And because on the one hand, we have historical growth, and on the other hand, we have direct care workers who are still paid at a lower wage than many other industries for, frankly, easier work. So I think the task at hand is challenging, and we need to ensure that folks do have access to the care, and we don't even know what that other N is out there of folks that are struggling.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director Bailey, because I think, you know, as we're having this conversation about the dollars that we spend on average and that we expect to spend, that doesn't even include all of the eligible Minnesotans who could be receiving services, and a lot who, like, desperately would need these services and just haven't gotten on them for one reason or another: lack of workforce, barriers to paperwork, lack of support in their own life to have somebody help them get into these services, right? And then if you add on, if somebody's had lack of resources that lead them to housing and food insecurity, those, of course, are going to be their number one priorities. And, I mean, trying to get services on top of that is just, I mean, you know, you can see how folks spiral through this process. So I guess just for this committee and for representatives here, I just want us to keep in mind that without any changes in state revenue, we would still struggle to find funding to get folks where they should be now. And that's, you know, talking about, like, meeting the workforce shortages, getting people the services they need, getting people adequate living spaces. We are still falling woefully short. And that's without the state cuts that we're seeing in the governor's proposal. That's without these massive federal cuts, right? So I just really want to center us in that we have got to look at ways that we can reconfigure our state revenue so that we can meet the challenges that people need. And we'll have, even if we don't have these massive federal cuts, but I mean, I think we're looking at that too. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grant. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So I think Representative Gander maybe touched on this a little bit, but on page 14, the impacts currently, am I understanding this correctly, 11.7 in 24-25 and then increased to 78.7 in 26-27, or is 11.7 not the current expenditures? Can you just sort that out so I understand the sevenfold increase in those numbers?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob. So what we're showing you on that page, we'll start with the 11.7 million in fiscal year 24-25. What that's telling you in the February forecast is that for the period of fiscal years 24-25, the current biennium, we are projecting 11.7 million more in state spending on Medicaid pharmacy than we had projected in when we last did the forecast in November. And then those other numbers, the 78.7 million in the next biennium, we're projecting 78.7 million more in pharmacy or Medicaid pharmacy spending through managed care in the next biennium than in this forecast in February than we had in November. And the reason that we're projecting that is the growth. We're attributing that to the growth in claims and expenditures for a particular pharmacy prescription, which would be weight loss drugs. So the reason we're able to do that in February and not November is because we have a year's worth of data to show the increase from 23 to 24 in the calendar years. So we've got a full year of data to say, yeah, this is growing, and it's going to stay this way. It's not going to. This isn't. You know, the increases we were seeing in 23 are real, or the what we were seeing in 24 over 23 is real, and it's going to probably stay that way. And that's why we're projecting this growth in the out years as well.
Representative Jacob.
It doesn't seem to have much of a. 11.7 to 78.7 is a sevenfold, and then into the next biennium, just only a small increase. So, to try to justify, I calculate and justify a $66 million increase in one biennium, but not previously or following.
CFO Grimmett.
Mr. Chair, I understand the question now. Sorry, I wasn't following your question completely. What we're showing is that there has been a growth in the claims for weight loss drugs, and it has been increasing over time. We only started covering weight loss drugs in fiscal year 22. So the growth has been, and the growth was actually quite slow in the first year, and it's only really beginning to pick up now. So the reason there's only 11.7 million in growth in 24 and 25 is because we're seeing the growth happen very recently or fairly recently. So it really is only showing up in part of the 24-25 biennium, in the latter half actually. And so that's where we're seeing the growth. It's significant, and we're seeing it across other states that also cover weight loss drugs through Medicaid. So it is a fairly recent phenomenon. So that's why you're not seeing a lot of spending in 24-25, because there wasn't a lot of spending initially. However, as we end the biennium, the current biennium, we are seeing significant growth. And so the growth is starting to happen, but it's happening in the latter half of the biennium, maybe even the last 6 months, in particular in calendar year 25, because we're actually amending the managed care contracts for calendar year 25. And so that would be the last 6 months of fiscal years 24 and 25. If that makes sense, because 24-25, the 25 biennium ends June 30th of 25. So you have 6 months of calendar year 25 to include those higher costs, but then they go on into the future.
Representative Jacob.
Okay, well, I understand the explanation. I just don't think I still see the flow correctly. But I'll move on to a second question. I think maybe Representative Hicks and Representative Gander might have touched on it just slightly. So on slide 16, where we get the statement, the forecast reflects $113 million in payments since 2015 that should have been from a state source all along. So, and then we discussed, or you discussed, the sources of state and federal funding. And so for myself, again, coming from county background, in correcting this issue, how might that affect local property taxes?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jacob, that's a really good question, and it was one that we looked at carefully as well. When it comes to, this is a complicated way that we finance a lot of our behavioral health services in the state. There is, in some cases, a county share for services that are provided. Not always, but sometimes. And so where this gets complicated is where services provided in what we call these IMDs, residential providers with more than 16 beds, there is a county share when it's only state funding paying for it, with an exception if it is a tribal provider. So there should not be a county share attached to this change. It would be 100% state funded. State statute does provide an exception from requiring a county share when these SUD, residential SUD provider services, are provided by a tribal provider. So there should not be a county share attached to that. We have been communicating with the counties about this issue.
Representative Jacob.
Yeah, just to follow up, and then I'll let you get on to the next question. Just the statement that it's very complicated. It just sends a lot of, I guess, doubts onto local governments, and it seems like they're kind of the fail-safe for the state when the state doesn't have funding. So just be aware that myself and others will pay very close attention to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jacob. Representative Vernig.
Thank you, Chair. I have a few questions. So first, I just want to say thank you for owning the mistake by DHS. I know it's not easy to come and say that, so I appreciate it versus coming and trying to be evasive, or you just, I appreciate the openness. One of the questions I have is, are you doing outreach to the tribes? Because when we were on slide 16, you said you assume that they'll enroll in the next two and a half years. What kind of outreach are you doing to help foster or encourage that?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, that's a great question. And that was one of the first things we did when we discovered this issue, is talk to the tribes that operate these IMDs to make sure that they understood how this would or would not impact them. Because what they've been doing is submitting claims, as they should be doing, for the services that they provide. They had no idea that this was happening, and it was an error on the DHS side. So we needed to go and just, we have been, our leadership has been meeting with tribal leadership to discuss this issue, and I think there's been more staff-level conversations as well about what this means to the tribes in terms of submitting, continuing to submit invoices, continue to draw down funds. And we've also, brought up the issue of enrolling in the waiver. It's obviously a voluntary for them if they choose to do so. We want to be sure that they're aware that they can do that. They don't have to, but we are working with them and we'll be very supportive and we'll assist them if they choose to do so. Because there's an advantage to having, on the state level, to have federal funds doing this. So we have been doing a lot of outreach with these tribal members, and we've been meeting with them to make sure that they're aware of the situation.
Great, thank you.
Senator Vernick.
Thank you. Like Representative Gander, I also had some questions about the GLP-1, and I sat on the school board, and a few years ago, our biggest healthcare expense were complex pregnancies, and then this year, we were informed the biggest expense, and there have been double-digit increases in healthcare costs, were around the weight loss medications. Do you know, is there, I mean, we're the state, right? And clearly we're seeing it here, we're seeing it in education. Do we have bulk purchasing power to help bring down those costs, or has that ever been done in the past around a medication that seems to be impacting multiple different sectors to help lower costs?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe in a past life I recall that there being some discussion about bulk purchasing. I don't know that it involved Medicaid. The way we purchase with Medicaid is we cover, you know, we use a our pharmacy benefit staff, I can't remember what it's called now. It's a group of providers and members of the public and health professionals that identify drugs that should be put on a preferred drug list.
DRC.
What's that?
DRC.
Sorry. Drug,
That's not
formulary.
Yeah,
drug formulary committee. Thank you. Thank you, somebody, for helping me with that one.
That's what it is.
Drug formulary committee that identifies drugs to be put on a preferred drug list. And many of these weight loss drugs are put on a preferred drug list. And so what that means is we often get an enhanced rebate for those drugs, which we would not be seeing yet, that rebate revenue. We also, and there's other benefits to being on that list. But we do not at this time purchase in bulk. Through Medicaid, what the CMS requires is that if we're going to cover prescription drugs, we have to cover drugs that are FDA approved for that particular treating that particular condition, and the pharmacy manufacturer set the price, and the prices are very expensive, and that's one of the reasons why we're seeing a lot of increase.
Director Bailey.
Can I add? Chair Schumacher, Representative, I would say in the governor's budget, we have a few proposals around pharmacy. We have a pharmacy carve-out, which would take pharmacy claims out of the managed care contracts, and it would be authorized through a sole administrator. And that would enable us to pull down more federal rebate and save on the administrative costs that we pay managed care plans. We also are extending the drug formulary committee into perpetuity right now. There's a sunset on that, and that results in our inability to draw down those rebates that Mr. Greenman talked about. So if you're interested in those topics, there's certainly some interaction, I would think, with these weight loss drug costs.
Representative Bernig.
Great, thank you. Just one final note. I have a House file 1911 that addresses IT modernization. I'd encourage you to check it out. And so does Representative Nelson also has a bill that should be coming out hopefully soon to address it. But we're both kind of nerdy around IT modernization, so thanks.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comment is more just comments, not really a question. Members, we hear a lot about the cuts that are coming, but what we should have done is been listening to the warning signs that we had starting last year that we were going to be going into a deficit. And while we can blame Donald Trump and his quote-unquote handler, Representative Fisher, and as you were saying, Donald Trump, I was saying, say the words, say Elon Musk. You did not disappoint me. But as we know, President Trump does not need any handlers. But all this could have been avoidable. We started 2 years ago with a budget surplus of $18 billion. Taxes were raised by nearly $10 billion. So do the math. Not very good with math myself, as we all have heard on the House floor many times. But $28 billion is what basically was squandered. And now we are having to pinch pennies and going to have to make some drastic cuts in order to avoid the fiscal cliff that we are running straight into, like lemmings just falling off the cliff. With a 40% increase in state government, we kept warning that this was unsustainable. And unfortunately, this committee and the health committee are going to bear the brunt of those choices that were made over the last 2 years. And we also need to take accountability, and we can't blame the federal government for the choices or for the position that we're in right now. And we have to, much like DHS, taking accountability for the missed payments there. We need to take accountability and admit that we were wrong and that we should have been pinching pennies over the last 2 years. And that's all I'm going to say.
Thank you, Representative Franzen. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to note that the agency error is something troubling, and I'm glad that the agency is taking the right steps with also the tribal consultation to make sure that we can really address this issue. It's a massive system. I understand the billing codes and so many other things that many things may go wrong. I'm hoping that we can put the controls that are needed just to make sure that we can check and verify how we interact with the funding mechanism that we have. With that, I just wanted to ask a few questions. If you look at page 7, it looks like fiscal year 24-25, the anticipated increase is 1.9%, and then 26-27 is also 1.9%. And it goes down to 1.6. That seems to be a little bit of a miracle that we are going down in the out year. Can anyone explain the big difference and shift there?
We're deliberating. Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, I think that's a great question. I think it's probably a multitude of factors since that's rolled up on all of the updated claims and numbers in the forecast. You know, there's some items that are just temporary increases, such as the slower delay to CFSS and the one-time, you know, uptick in managed care payments according to acuity. And there's other things that are trending up and base adjustments that are ongoing. So we can get you maybe a more simplified table that outlays the areas that are more of a one-time factor versus an ongoing factor.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Speaking of savings, starting with CFSS, I think we can see the shift whereby the state is going to see an enhanced federal match of 6%, which will reduce the cost. But we're also looking at how can we transition the individuals who have not, I mean, the agencies that we have not transitioned, is there a plan so that we can also see some savings in the next few months and also next fiscal year?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, my understanding is that the challenge has been on the consultation services piece and having enrolled providers, enough providers to assist people as their service agreements renew or their plans renew. And that has led to kind of a slower transition. I can ask folks if there's any solutions we can come up with to speed that up. But my understanding is right now we've adjusted the forecast to ensure that anyone who can't transition due to lack of access to consultation maintains their current level of service. So we don't have any, you know, interruptions in, for the person. So that's been kind of the rub, is trying to transition as anticipated while also, you know, making sure that the provider and the industry is ready and available to assist folks as they do that.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that also include the parent and spousal caregiver? Because we funded temporary, because some of them were, you know, we're allowing them to use PCA with state funding. Are we going to be able to transition anyone who is using parent and spousal caregiver option so that we can also expedite that as part of the conversation?
Director Bailey.
Chair Schumacher, Representative Knorr, I can double confirm with folks, but my understanding is that that transitions as CFSS is implemented. So it is certainly interconnected with the take up or the transition to CFSS to ensure people have seamless access, but I can double confirm. That's my understanding.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because we did a small funding just to cover the transition period for those individuals to stay within PCA. So we need to look into that if we need to really make some adjustment. But also these are individuals who are in different programs. You know, they were in FMS, they were in CSG or different other programs because they were being given services in a different setting. Now we're allowing them to pull into the CFSS. So I'm looking forward to seeing what we're doing there. Mr. Chair, I also wanted to go back a little bit on the federal cuts. As we look at the on slide, it shows, I believe it's the beginning, number four, the basic care adults without kids. So the federal match is about 90%. The federal poverty guideline is about 138%. So we increased the federal poverty guideline, but we're also drawing 90%. Based on your assumption, sorry, is this the group that is going to be significantly impacted, or is it going to be the 80%, which is mostly elderly and disabled individuals, who are going to be impacted by the budget cuts if it happens from the federal government?
Mr. Chair,
Greenman.
Representative Nora, I think it's really difficult to predict who's going to be impacted or how they would be impacted, because it really depends on what if any proposals come forward to actually enact that level of reduction. It could be, and how the state reacts, frankly, what policy measures the state takes up to respond to those reductions. It's certainly possible that that enhanced FMAP that we currently receive for that ACA expansion group might be reduced down to the level that other populations have, which would be pretty significant impact. There would have to be then some difficult conversations about how to actually absorb that kind of a reduction and where we would absorb it. I think that's really the challenge with understanding what those what the impacts on Minnesota might be. But we are doing a lot right now to try to assess how we would be impacted by the various things that we've been hearing. We just don't really know right now.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the current number is at 50%, so that's what we're looking into if it happens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, around like 51%-ish. Yeah, it varies from year to year.
Representative Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the page 14, so the GLP-1, the manufacturer set the prices. Do we see any increases in the price from the manufacturers that may increase the cost to the state?
CFO Greenman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norris, the prices that manufacturers charge for these drugs are kept very private, confidential. We are not allowed. I don't even know what the prices are. That we pay for them. That's a very federal requirements limit knowing what those prices are, as I understand it, because of, I think it's, you know, trade secrets. I'm not sure what the exact reference is, but there are, there's a lot of restrictions around having access to what those prices are. There are staff at our agency that have those, but we're very limited in terms of our ability to share or talk about what those prices are. I think that what I've seen is what we pay per claim has not, when I look at the increase from calendar year 23 to 24, what's increasing is the number of claims, not necessarily the price per claim. That increased by about 2%. It's the number of claims that increased, that roughly doubled.
Representative Knorr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I just add one?
CFO Greenman.
Thank you. In response to your first question, Representative Knorr, about what looked like sort of a slowdown in the growth in the planning years in 2029, I just want to put a shameless plug in for DHS's forecast summary, which we produce. That's on our website. It has what we call our nutshell, which lists each major change in the forecast spending. I think it's one of the documents we're linking to, if I'm not mistaken, at the end. We can make sure to get that to the committee, but that has a very handy way to identify all of the different moving pieces, and I think that's really helpful. The one thing that looks like maybe affecting things, and I think Budget Director Bailey's absolutely right, there is a lot of moving pieces here when you've got $20 billion in spending. it does look like there is some projected continued growth in waiver spending, but slower than had been in 26, 27. So that might be where it is, but I think I really suggest you look at this. This is a very helpful document to have.
Representative Norr?
No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, CFO Greenman, Director Bailey. Thank you for your presentation today and answering our questions for the last hour. We know that you had the option of being in the Senate this morning, and you chose us, and so we are grateful for that. Members, we have no further business on the agenda for today. We get to come back tomorrow morning, March 12th at 8:15. See you then. We are adjourned.